and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, August 24th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. Our top headline, County to Reinstate House Arrest Program. Dubuque County law enforcement officials plan to reinstate a house arrest program with ankle monitoring as an alternative to jail sentences for certain would-be inmates. The County Board of Supervisors recently unanimously approved a contract to lease monitoring equipment for the program. The county has not utilized house arrest since the last program was discontinued in the early 2000s. During the supervisors' meeting, Sheriff Joe Kennedy said the program is an attempt to reduce the jail population. Officials this spring dramatically reduced the number of people being held in the Dubuque jail over fears that COVID-19 would easily spread among inmates. There were 186 inmates on March 1st, about 125 as of April 1st, and the number has been pretty consistently near 100 in much of the time since, including as of last week. This pandemic was maybe a little bit of a wake-up call, Supervisor Dave Baker said. Does everybody in the jail really need to be incarcerated if they're nonviolent offenders if we can monitor them? Kennedy said house arrest with monitoring also is a better way to serve people with medical conditions or are nonviolent offenders. They would be better served outside in the community, where they could maintain their employment, maintain their responsibilities to their families, he said. The program will be enacted by leasing the monitoring equipment from Attenti, to whom Kennedy reached out to start the process. The county will pay $4.50 per monitor per day for the program. We only have to pay this company when the monitors are in use, Kennedy explained. It's a small price. He expects that, at most, the county would have a dozen or so people participating in the program at any one time. If 12 monitors were in use daily, the cost would be about $19,700 per year. The house arrest model requires far less government financing than housing an inmate inside the jail. The participating individuals will pay the same as they would if they were jailed, Kennedy said. We're hoping that it becomes a self-sustaining project, he said. Although it costs less than $5 a day for us to rent the equipment when it's being used by an inmate, we will charge our normal room and board rate of $55 a day to cover employee expenses and also build up a bank so that if the equipment is damaged, we'll have that to pay for repairs. Kennedy said it costs $1,200 to replace one set of monitoring equipment. Supervisor Ann McDonough pointed out that the Sheriff's Department does not operate inside a bubble, however. I applaud you for thinking outside the box and looking into this, she told Kennedy. But you would be working also with the judges. There are some other people who have to review this as well. Kennedy said a deputy had reached out to some county judges prior to presenting the resolution and that everybody seems to be on board. Iowa District Court Judge Thomas Bitter said he did not know all the details of the Dubuque County plan, but that generally, GPS monitoring is a useful tool, particularly before the case gets to a trial. It offers certain defendants the ability to bond out of jail, but yet it provides additional security for the community, or sometimes for a specific victim, he wrote in an email response. It can also allow some defendants the ability to continue pursuing substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment that they may not otherwise get in jail. Kennedy said his office still is hashing out the final policy for the program with partners. Before we institute it, we want to give the attorneys and the judges across the street what we came up with, he said. He said the plan is to start the program in September. Kennedy said his goal is to start with people who were sentenced to 2 or 5 to 5 days in jail in order to work out any bugs. Down the road, the program might extend to people awaiting sentencing. He envisions the house arrest program being handled by existing jail staff with the time that Kennedy anticipates they will save by separating the jail's largest housing blocks. That $700,000 project is set to begin in the coming weeks. Outdoor dining, entertainment options, buoy local marinas. Glenda and Mike Wilson of Peosta have always enjoyed taking their boat out on the Mississippi River, but it's an activity they've been doing even more during the COVID-19 pandemic. When you're on your boat, you're on your boat. You can stay socially distant, and the drinks are priced right, Mike Wilson said. The couple has also been taking advantage of the outdoor dining offered by area marinas, including at Midtown Marina recently. They also noted Millennium Bar and Marina and Catfish Charlie's as places they've enjoyed. They have gone out of their way to make it a safe environment for everyone, Glenda Wilson said. Jeremy McDowell, owner of Midtown Marina, said business started off a little slow during the pandemic, but he has since been amazed by the amount of people eating on the marina's patio. People are feeling caged up, they're boxed up, so they're happy to be able to go someplace, he said. People miss being social. McDowell added that he's seen more people come to Midtown this summer that he doesn't recognize right away, meaning the marina is reaching beyond its regular crowd. Not only have people been enjoying meals overlooking the water and dock, behind Midtown, but they come for the live music as well. There's plenty of space on the patio for a band, McDowell said. They do encourage people not to dance. Samantha Trentz, owner of Millennium Bar in Marina, said she chose to cancel the bar's live music since the deck wouldn't be big enough. However, she said more and more people have been taking advantage of the outdoor seating as the summer has gone on. While the bar has limited hours, she said there's usually a steady crowd when doors are open. Picnic tables have been set up to add even more seats. There have been a lot more kayakers coming up from the river this year, Trent said. Also, Millennium's floating cabin Airbnb has been rented out every weekend of the summer, with some people traveling as long as 8 hours to stay there. However, she said COVID-19 has still hurt the marina. People are less leery about eating out, she said, be it indoors or outdoors. If these restrictions stay in place, we're going to lose 75% of our seating, she said about the upcoming fall weather. Mary Knupp, owner of Frenchress Lake Bar and Grill, says she thinks there will be new health and safety rules for restaurants to follow once the pandemic is over. She says she's wanted to start up a breakfast menu at Frenchress Lake, but she's still unsure of what the rules will be surrounding buffets. We'll try to do whatever we can as long as we can do it. We're figuring it out just like everybody else, Knupp said. Everybody's hurting. We don't know what the new normal is going to be. This summer, Knupp said the restaurant has been much busier than she anticipated. Frenchress Lake opened in April, about a month after the pandemic began, with carryout options before opening outdoor dining. She noted the bar is especially busy on Friday nights, Saturday nights, and Sunday afternoons when live bands perform. As the summer season comes to a close, marina owners are looking for ways to keep business flowing. McDowell said Midtown typically has Iowa Hawkeyes football parties on Saturdays during the football season. Since the Hawkeyes fall season was canceled, he said the marina is exploring options like beanbag tournaments. We have a fair amount of Hawkeye season ticket holders, he said. Maybe now they'll be out on their boats longer. Millennium Bar Marina is open year-round, Trent said, and she plans to offer indoor seating and with precautions once it gets too chilly for outdoor dining. Currently, the bar has indoor seating limited to 4 tables. We'd rather play it safe in order to keep the business open, she said. The operators of the Dubuque Marina and Yardarm were unavailable for an interview before publication of this story. Galena Auto Dealer settles into new site. An auto dealership in Galena has consolidated its operations into a new, highly visible facility along US 20. Galena Chrysler moved to a newly constructed building at 11300 US 20 in June. The business previously operated out of 2 separate locations at 937 Galena Square Drive and 10840 US 20. The dealership vacated those 2 buildings when the new one opened, and the old properties are now for sale, according to Roseanne Schroman. She and her husband, John Wilson, own the dealership. To them, there is plenty to like about the new building, which was constructed in a lot in front of the city's Walmart. The footprint of this new building is comparable to the other 2 put together, Schroman said, and it's such a highly visible location. Galena Chrysler employs 20 people. The dealership sells new Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles, as well as a variety of used models. It also continues to serve a niche market, selling right-hand drive Jeeps in which the steering wheel is located on the opposite side as usual. The vehicles are frequently utilized by rural mail carriers, Schroman said. The dealership service section is open from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, and the sales department is open from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on weekdays and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturdays. The business can be reached at 815-777-4477. A new restaurant soon will open within a convenience store on Dubuque's West End. Papa Oz is slated to open in the Quick Stop at 3340 John F. Kennedy Road. Tessa Fahey, Director of Restaurant Operations for Quick Stop's parent company, Rainbow Oil, said renovations are underway and the new eatery should open in September. It will fill a space that has been vacant since 2018, when Fazoli's closed that location. Fahey believes Quick Stop customers and nearby residents have missed having a restaurant there. There are a lot of new houses on that side of town, and I think that has created a lot of demand for something like this, Fahey said. Fahey said she is unsure of precisely what the restaurant's menu will look like, but noted that pizza likely will be among the staple items. She said Papa Oz also plans to serve breakfast. She confirmed the location will be owned by Ozzy Ramadani, who owns Point Cafe in Dubuque. Ramadani did not return calls for comment. A Galena shop recently opened a new section within its storefront that harkens back to the building's previous use. A Darkness Lovely at 304 South Main Street now sells a varied selection of yarn and craft supplies, in a newly designed portion of the store named the Stitching Hour. Owners Robin Davis and Ted Williams added the products after fielding multiple inquiries from customers, many of whom would point out that their storefront formerly housed the yarn store, Fiberwild. Davis believes this is an opportune time to add such a section. Millennials are getting into crafting, knitting, and stitching, she said. It's not just for grandmas anymore. A Darkness Lovely operates under the umbrella of Haunted Galena Tour Company, an entity also owned by Davis and Williams. Out of the location at 304 South Main Street, they offer tickets to the company's tours and also sell a wide selection of books, games, and other products. Throughout the store, we are really focused on independent artists and authors and supporting small businesses, Davis said. A Darkness Lovely is open Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The business can be contacted at 815-990-7203. An Elkader Archery Range soon will unveil a new virtual experience to customers. Dave Fulks, the owner of Cutting Edge Archery, said the business will add an archery simulation program in late 2020. The system allows customers to take part in a virtual hunting experience that can be programmed to the user's preference. Customers then shoot real arrows that are tracked in the virtual experience by sensors. It is going to be a big draw, I think, Fulks said. This is something I was hoping to do for a while. It was just a question of when it would happen. He was able to accelerate his timetable after receiving a $10,000 grant through the Main Street Iowa Open for Business program. Cutting Edge Archery started out of Fulks' home in 2016 and moved to its current location at 103 Mulberry Street about 2 years ago. It currently offers a 3D range with foam animals and other targets. Cutting Edge Archery is open from 9:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. The business can be reached at 563-245-2075. In our People Etc. article, City naming sewage plant after comedian John Oliver. A Connecticut town's officials are showing comedian John Oliver what they think about his expletive-filled rant about their city. They're naming the local sewage treatment plant after him. Danbury Mayor Mark Boughton announced the tongue-in-cheek move in a video posted on his Facebook page on Saturday that shows him at the plant. We are going to rename it the John Oliver Memorial Sewage Plant. John Oliver Memorial Sewer Plant, the Republican mayor says. Why? Because it's full of crap just like you, John. The new name comes after a recent episode of HBO's Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, in which he explored the racial disparities in the jury selection process, citing problems in a few Connecticut towns. I know exactly three things about Danbury, Oliver said during the segment. USA Today ranked it the second best city to live in 2015. It was once the center of the American hat industry. And if you're from there, you have a standing invite to come get a thrashing from John Oliver, children excluded, and then it says, expletive, you. It wasn't exactly clear what prompted Oliver to go off on Danbury. A message-seeking comment was left for his agent Sunday. Oliver also made fun of Boughton and other American mayors in 2017 over videos they made seeking to attract Amazon's second world headquarters. In Boughton's new video, he also mentions that Amazon has decided to open a distribution facility in Danbury, although it's not the second world headquarters. And oh, by the way, thanks for showing that Amazon video, Boughton says to Oliver at the end of the video. We did get Amazon here in Danbury. And from our almanac section, with today, Monday, August 24th, it is the 237th day of 2020. There are 129 days left in the year. And on this date in history, in 79 AD, long dormant Mount Vesuvius erupted, burying the Roman cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum in volcanic ash. An estimated 20,000 people died. In 410 AD, Rome was overrun by the Visigoths, a major event in the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And in 1814, during the War of 1812, British forces invaded Washington, D.C., setting fire to the Capitol, which was still under construction, and the White House, as well as other public buildings. Pompeo heads to Mideast in Arab-Israeli push. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Sunday headed to the Middle East, the first of two senior U.S. officials to travel to the region this week as the Trump administration presses an ambitious Arab-Israeli peace push that could burnish President Donald Trump's foreign policy credentials ahead of November's election. Pompeo is traveling to Israel, several Gulf Arab states, and Sudan, and will be away when he is scheduled to speak on Tuesday to the Republican National Convention, which will nominate Trump for a second term. Should Pompeo appear by remote or recorded video, it will break a long tradition of secretaries of state declining to participate in the public political nomination process. Previous secretaries of state have shunned overtly partisan rhetoric. Pompeo's three immediate predecessors made a point of being out of the country and unavailable during their political party's presidential nominating events. If Pompeo's planned speech to the convention goes ahead, he is likely to tout Trump's Mideast policies and the recent agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates to normalize relations. To accelerate progress in the region, Pompeo is expected to be followed to many of the same destinations later in the week by Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, diplomats said. The separate visits come as the administration seeks to capitalize on momentum from the historic agreement between Israel and the UAE. In addition to Israel and Sudan, the State Department said Pompeo would travel to Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates. The U.S. commitment to peace, security, and stability in Israel, Sudan, and among Gulf countries has never been stronger than under President Trump's leadership, the State Department said in a statement announcing Pompeo's trip. Kushner and his team are expected to visit Israel, Bahrain, Oman, Saudi Arabia, and Morocco on their trip, which is scheduled to begin at the end of the week, according to the diplomats, who spoke on condition of anonymity because the itinerary has not yet been finalized or publicly announced. Pompeo's and Kushner's trips both are aimed at building on the success of the Israel-UAE agreement by finalizing at least one and potentially more normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel in the near future. Now moving into the Dubuque and Tri-State section, top headline, Iowa reports first child death linked to COVID-19. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Sunday's developments included, Dubuque County reported five additional COVID-19 cases in the 24-hour period from 5 p.m. Saturday to 5 p.m. Sunday for a county total of 1,903. There were no additional related deaths in Dubuque County, where the toll remained at 35. With five new cases and 45 new tests reported in the county, the 24-hour positivity rate was 11%. The county's overall rate stood at 8.3%. During the 14-day period that ended at 5 p.m. Sunday, there were 231 new confirmed cases and 2,287 new tests, equating to a positivity rate of 10.1%. The Telegraph Herald's calculation, based on the state's totals, continues to exceed the state's 14-day positivity rate due to the state's practice of not counting recent confirmed cases until all data is received, such as the date of birth of the testee. This practice drives down the positivity rate, even though those cases have been confirmed in a specific county. The state on Sunday calculated Dubuque County's 14-day positivity rate through Saturday at 7.1%. Dubuque County reported 1,354 individuals as recovered from the illness, an increase of 8 over the previous 24-hour period. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered from the number of confirmed cases, there are 514 active cases in the county as of 5 p.m., three fewer than the previous 24-hour period. Jones County reported four additional cases, increasing the county's total to 151. Clayton, Delaware, and Jackson counties each reported one additional case, and their counties' totals grew to 152, 162, and 180, respectively. There were no additional deaths reported in the Iowa counties in the Telegraph Herald coverage area. Statewide, Iowa reported 543 additional cases for a total of 56,276. The state reported five additional related deaths for a statewide toll of 1,036. The state reported the first child death related to COVID-19. A child under the age of 5 died in June, according to a press release. The release states that the child had significant underlying health conditions. State officials reported the death now after ensuring the individual's identity would remain protected and notifying family, according to the release. Grant County reported an additional case to increase the county's total to 421. The county reported that 353 individuals have now recovered, 8 more than the previous 24-hour period. Crawford and Iowa counties each reported two additional cases, increasing their totals to 95 and 109, respectively. Lafayette County reported one additional case for a county total of 183. There were no additional deaths reported in the four counties. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 453 additional cases to increase the state's total to 70,462 as of 5 p.m. Sunday. There are no additional deaths reported in Wisconsin, so the toll remains at 1,081. Joe Davies County reported two additional cases to increase the county's total to 165. There were no additional related deaths reported in Joe Davies County, where the toll remains 2. Statewide, Illinois reported 1,893 additional cases for a total of 220,178. There were 6 additional deaths, and that tally stood at 7,880 at 5 p.m. Sunday. Food for thought, Platteville couple generous. Each week, Maggie and Steve Claseth make trips to a produce auction near Fenimore to pick up food. The Platteville couple comes home with a van full of tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, zucchini, or other produce that the two give to the Platteville food pantry, the local senior center, and a pair of senior apartments. We've been blessed, and we feel it's important to make sure that people can get good food and can get some fresh vegetables, especially, Maggie said. The Claseths have been purchasing produce for people who need it for around 7 years now. They say their drive to volunteer their time comes from a love of sharing food with others and making them happy. The big reason we do it is to watch the face of a lot of these people, Steve said. It just brings happiness and joy to them. The Claseths make their weekly trips to the produce auction from June through October. Typically, they pay for some of the food, and auction officials donate some produce that isn't sold. The Platteville Main Street program received a grant to help the Claseths cover costs this year. Maggie does most of the bidding, and I do most of the carrying, Steve said. Afterward, they make their deliveries to the food pantry and to local seniors. The Claseths also have a large garden, so they add their own produce to the mix as well. Maggie said she figures they reach about 100 families in total. Maggie is retired now, but she traced her interest in providing food to her former work as the food service director at the Platteville School District. She also runs the annual Alone for Christmas community meal. I no longer feed little kids or teenagers and elementary kids, but I still feel it's a calling, and I really like to be able to share that, she said. Dolores D. Wolf, who is on the board for the food pantry, said the Claseths have contributed all kinds of produce to the food pantry and packaged it up for families to take home. She described them as friendly, outgoing, and always willing to help with a project. They are very kind-hearted, and they do not want to see people go without when they know there's food out here that could be used, Wolf said. Maggie said seeing the gratitude of the people who receive produce from the couple makes the time and energy of the pair's efforts worthwhile. It's just the pleasure of knowing that we're really making people happy, she said. That's really the major reason we do it. Dubuque County Emergency Radio System set to officially switch over in November. Dubuque County's updated emergency radio system will not be officially implemented until near the end of the year, according to county officials. Last week, members of the Dubuque County 911 Public Safety Committee discussed beginning the testing phase of the system at the end of August. Officials will need to test the signal strength of the system for the entirety of the county. In September 2017, Dubuque County supervisors voted to bond for about $10 million to revamp the emergency communication system to meet the latest federal standards. The upgrades also are expected to improve radio coverage for all emergency response agencies in the county. In March, county officials told the Telegraph Herald that testing for the new system was expected to begin in June, with the system going operational sometime in the fall. At the time, the project was about a year behind schedule. Thomas Berger, Dubuque County Emergency Management Director, said testing was delayed mostly due to issues with the construction of the system's 6 new radio towers. Berger said the emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic created restrictions for contractors working on the towers, along with causing delays in the arrival of essential parts from manufacturers. Some of these were specialized pieces of equipment that we had to reorder, so that delayed things, Berger said. We figured the system is going to last us 25 years, so we wanted to make sure we did it right. Berger said he now anticipates emergency services in the county will switch over to the new system in November. Testing of the system will include driving throughout the entirety of the county to determine radio signal strength. Important buildings, including schools and government offices, also will need to be tested. Mark Murphy, 911 communication manager, said the testing will be a lengthy process that will involve assistance from local consultants and RACOM, Raycom. We want to make sure that we are getting full coverage of the county, Murphy said. On a positive note, Berger said testing the system in the fall will serve as the best indicator of the strength of the new system. That's when trees are at full foliage, Berger said. It's when we would see the most interference. Now in our news in brief, officer among two people injured in fire at Darlington apartment building. Police said two people were injured, including an officer, in a fire Sunday at an apartment building in Darlington. The police officer, whose name was not released, suffered smoke inhalation and was taken by ambulance to Memorial Hospital of Lafayette County for treatment, according to Police Chief Jason King. The officer was released later in the day. The resident, whose name also was not released, was treated by emergency responders at the scene and released. King reported that emergency responders were dispatched to the fire in the three-unit apartment building in the 300 block of Main Street at about 3:30 a.m. Sunday. Preliminary findings suggest a tenant left items on the stovetop and fell asleep, a press release states. A fire started, filling the building with smoke. The officer, who suffered smoke inhalation, was evacuating residents from the structure. King reported that the blaze was quickly extinguished by firefighters when they arrived. Authorities paused river search for man. Authorities on Sunday afternoon stopped their search for a man who reportedly fell into the Mississippi River at Dubuque on Saturday night. Police received a call at about 6:30 p.m. Saturday that a 31-year-old man had fallen into the river near Schmidt Harbor, according to Lieutenant Ted McClyman. They stopped searching at 3 p.m. Sunday and will reassess in the morning, McClyman said at 4:30 p.m. Sunday. McClyman said agencies assisting police include the Dubuque and East Dubuque, Illinois Fire Departments, Dubuque County Conservation, Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and the U.S. Coast Guard. Authorities did not immediately release the man's name. Dubuque schools out 2 hours early today. Dubuque Community Schools will have a 2-hour early release on the first day of school today. The school district made the announcement Sunday evening, saying the decision was made given the forecast for very high heat index temperatures, combined with students and staff transitioning to wearing masks during the school day. And from the police department, the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments reported Michael L. Law, age 37, no permanent address, was arrested at 3:35 a.m. Sunday in the 2200 block of Francis Street on warrants charging domestic assault with injury, domestic assault, first-degree harassment, public intoxication, and three counts of violation of a restraining order and a charge of interference with official acts. Court documents state that Lott assaulted Patrice Green, age 49, of 2340 Central Avenue, No. 2, on August 17th. Heaven L. Smoot, age 29, of 205 West 13th Street, No. 4, was arrested at 11:48 p.m. Saturday at her residence on a charge of domestic assault with injury. Court documents state that Smoot assaulted William R. Lundgren, age 36, of 1301 Main Street, No. 1. Denisha L.S. Day, age 31, of 1701 1/2 Central Avenue, was arrested at 6:45 p.m. Saturday at Diamond Joe Casino on charges of assault on persons in certain occupations, public intoxication, and interference with official acts. Court documents state that Day assaulted Officer Nicole Bloom. Demetrius L. Woods, age 27, of 625 Alpine Street, No. 5, was arrested at 10:05 a.m. Saturday in the 2100 block of White Street on a warrant charging domestic assault and two counts of child endangerment and a charge of interference with official acts. Court documents state that Woods assaulted Letitia M. Swanigan, age 25, of Asbury, Iowa, on July 27th in the presence of two children. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, August 24th, 2020. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Lawrence L. Timmerman, known as Larry, age 83, of Dickeyville, Wisconsin, died Friday, August 21st, at home, surrounded by family. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 25th, at Holy Ghost Catholic Church in Dickeyville, with Reverend Bernard Rott officiating. Services will be live-streamed through Facebook on the funeral home page. Burial will be in the church cemetery. A public visitation for friends will be held from 9:30 to 11:15 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Individuals with health concerns may come from 9 to 9:30 a.m. The family requests you utilize masks during the duration of your visit in the church and that you practice social distancing. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Larry L.T. was born On July 9, 1937, on the farm outside of Dickeyville, the son of Vincent and Lillian Trimmerman. He graduated from Loras Academy. He married Donna R. Liebfried on February 15, 1958 at St. Andrew's Catholic Church in Tennyson. She preceded him in death on May 10, 2009. L.T. farmed, worked in construction, and was a truck driver. He was a member of the Wisconsin National Guard. He was a member of the Dickeyville Parish Fire Department for 48 years. LT loved tractor pulls, was inducted in the Grant County Tractor Pull Hall of Fame, and this passion is carried on by his grandsons, Jake and Cody. The Brewers were his favorite team, and he was always ready to talk about them. LT could name everyone in town, including their relatives, and tell stories about all of them. Most important to LT were his family and faith. Through the highs and lows of life, he never wavered. Survivors include three daughters, Rhonda Nowakowski and Renee Buchart, both of Milwaukee, and Roxanne Hartle of Hazel Green. Four sons, Tim Timmerman of Potosi, Todd Timmerman and Ted Timmerman, both of Dickeyville, and Tony Timmerman of Keeler. Three sisters, Kay Budin of Sinisinawa, and Jane Liebfried and Donna Frommel, both of Dubuque. A sister-in-law, Ellen Timmerman of Platteville, 16 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren, with 2 on the way. He was also preceded in death by his parents and a brother, Richard Timmerman. The family wishes to thank Dr. Kevin Carr and staff for all of your care and friendship, and a Grace Hospice of Platteville. Online condolences for the family may be left at www.caseymcnett.com. Robert W. Johnson, known as Bob, age 73, of Galena, died on Friday, August 21st. A funeral service will be held at noon Saturday, August 29th, in Greenwood Cemetery in Galena, where friends may call after 9 a.m., social distancing and masks will be encouraged. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Charles W. Yeager, known as Bill, age 77, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, August 23rd. Arrangements are pending at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and cremation service. Ruby Williams, age 90, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, August 22nd. Arrangements are pending at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and cremation service. Now, moving back over to news, we'll take a look here at what we have in our opinion section. Kamala Harris defies the soft bigotry of racial expectations. All the chatter surrounding the historic rise of Democratic vice president nominee Kamala Harris sounds like an unfortunate trip through a Wayback Machine. The "what is she?" questions about Harris, daughter of a mother from India and a father from Jamaica, sound eerily and perhaps inevitably similar to the questions that popped up in 2007 about how to label another rising candidate of color, Barack Obama. Like Obama, Harris challenges the soft bigotry of racial expectations. "We talk about her being African-American," mused Pat Robertson, a conservative media star and former Republican presidential candidate, after Joe Biden named her to be his running mate. "But her father's from Jamaica. He isn't from Africa. He's from Jamaica, so she's not really an American black." Yes, she is. She was born in Oakland, California, and besides, where does Robertson, a Yale Law School graduate, think that black Jamaicans originally came from? Conservative author Dinesh D'Souza put aside Harris's black lineage to observe on Laura Ingraham's Fox News program that Kamala Harris is descended from the largest slave owner, in Jamaica. Then he concluded, "Kamala Harris seems to be descended less from the legacy of, let's say, Frederick Douglass, than from the legacy of the plantation itself." Nice try, but Douglass, who escaped a Maryland plantation to become a renowned abolitionist, author, and diplomat, also was of mixed race, as are more than a few African Americans. Rush Limbaugh joined the sarcastic chorus angrily. "She's not African-American," he growled on his national talk show. "She doesn't have slave blood. She's not down for the struggle." And who is? Certainly not Limbaugh, in my humble view. Besides, as the Daily Show host Trevor Noah, a biracial South African, said while reporting these soundbites from the right wing, "being partially descended from a slave owner is one of the blackest things you can be." Indeed, so is having non-blacks persistently try to tell you what you can be. Race itself long ago has been based in this country on the one-drop rule. Just one drop of black blood in your background makes you black. As Malcolm X is said to have joked, that must be one powerful drop of blood to change the nature of the whole person, like a drop of ink in a glass of milk. As for the question of who's black enough, Race is a social construct, basically determined by two standards, in my view. What you see in looking at yourself, and what others see when they see you. As anti-racist author and race lecturer Tim Wise had said, color and who qualifies as black or white historically has been policed, not by the targets of oppression, but by those who set up the system of oppression. The good news is that outside the fever swamps of the right wing, this whole questionable questioning of Harris's lineage has not had much traction beyond President Donald Trump's recent feeble hints that Harris's actual citizenship might not be valid, despite her California birth. Happily, most Americans show no interest in renewing the wild goose chase that Trump stirred up by questioning Obama's birth certificate. And in communities of color, particularly Asian and African Americans, Harris's rise has been celebrated as a breakthrough for equal opportunity, even as left progressives sharply question some of her heavily punitive law and order positions as California's attorney general. In fact, ill-informed cheap shots from the political right appear only to have encouraged communities of color to support the Biden-Harris ticket all the more. As with Obama's first campaign, I welcome Harris's rise for its reaffirmation of this country's noble ideals of freedom and opportunity, despite our long-running rocky struggles to live up to those ideals. The chatter I see and hear in black circles, black-oriented media, and on social networks overwhelmingly praises Harris for her background as having been raised as a black child, having been bused for school desegregation in the Berkeley District, choosing Howard University, one of the nation's most prestigious HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, and membership in the Alpha Kappa Alpha, the nation's oldest black sorority. In short, neither she nor her AKA sisters or any other people of color need Limbaugh to tell them whether she is down for the struggle or not. We can judge that for ourselves and whether it matters. And that opinion article came from Clarence Page. He's a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize in 1989. Page is a Chicago Tribune columnist and editorial board member. He entered the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame in 1992. Going into the tri-state section, natural gas harvest planned at Southwest Wisconsin farms. A group of investors intends to transform sludge into cash using the manure created by Southwest Wisconsin dairy cows. Progressive Energy, a New Orleans-based natural gas developer, is undertaking a $55 million to $70 million venture that involves constructing facilities to process cattle waste into natural gas. We've already signed up a number of the participants who are interested in being part of the overall project, said Nick Seal, managing partner. To reduce costs, the investors have requested that the Lafayette County Board of Supervisors authorize the issuance of up to $55 million in bonds in the county's name. When a municipality serves as a conduit, bonds are issued at a lower interest rate, and the interest that accrues is exempt from state and federal taxes, reducing the project's cost. Neither the county nor taxpayers would incur financial liability or see tax impacts. The investors plan to contract with 5 to 7 dairy farmers in Lafayette and surrounding counties who milk at least 1,000 head of cattle. But the number of farms could double, said Steve Spensley, a partner and former county supervisor. If things go the way we expect, it's going to get big in the next 3 to 5 years, he said. Digesters will be constructed at the farms where the manure will be processed. The biogas that is released will be trucked to a farm where a scrubber will remove carbon dioxide and sulfur. Only methane, the primary component of natural gas, remains. Near Belmont, the methane will be pumped into a northern natural gas pipeline, which crosses Lafayette County. Meanwhile, processed manure can be used for livestock bedding and fertilizer. Operations could begin by July 2021, Seal said. The digesters could generate enough natural gas to meet the annual demand of more than 8,600 households. The investors have located a buyer but would not disclose the name. Contracted farmers will share in the returns. We are giving these smaller dairy farms an extra source of revenue, Seal said. The investors also estimate that 15 permanent jobs will be created. We can't support job creation for huge companies, said Lafayette County Economic Development Director Abby Haas. So, to have a company looking at us that can create these 15 jobs and still be a big project and get rid of one of our waste materials, I definitely think that's something worth looking at. The board will deliberate on the proposal at its September meeting, but Seal said the project will proceed even if the supervisors deny the request. County Board Chairman Jack Sauer described the project as a good deal all the way around. With time, it would pay for itself, he said. Businessman to challenge state senator. A political newcomer will face an incumbent state senator this November. Eric Green, age 35, of Monticello, is the Democrat challenging state senator Dan Zumbach, Republican of Ryan, for Iowa's 48th District Senate seat. I've never been involved in a campaign before, and I'm always excited about new challenges, Green said. I've had an interest in politics for a long time, and now I've jumped into it. Senate District 48 covers most of Delaware County, as well as portions of Jones, Lynn, and Buchanan counties. Green owns a pizzeria in Monticello, Diamond Pie. We're getting into year three of owning it, he said. There's a different challenge every day, and I like that. Green said the pizzeria has weathered the disruptions caused by COVID-19. We hit 2020, and suddenly you can't really look at last year's playbook, he said. Green was nominated at a virtual convention by district Democrats after no one ran in the primary. I normally work 7 days a week, open to close, but now I am taking a shift or two off a week for the campaign, he said. He added, I want to talk to a lot of people. I need their ideas and opinions to help inform my own. Green, who is unmarried and has no children, grew up in the Monticello area. He graduated from Monticello High School in 2003 and attended Iowa State University, where he worked for the Center for Sustainable Environmental Technologies. He said education is one of his top policy priorities. Green said local school districts need additional resources to meet students' needs. The kids are the future, and we need to give them the best possible start, he said. Green also backs raising the minimum wage, though that would affect his pizzeria. I would have to rethink things at my own business, but I think it's the right thing to do, he said. If you're working 40 hours a week, you should be able to provide for your family. Green said he would oppose tax breaks to corporations that did not require a substantial number of jobs with a sustainable wage. Zumbach, a farmer, was first elected in 2012. Races are races, and I take them all seriously, Zumbach said. I think I have represented the folks very well, am listening to them and doing the things they want me to do. Zumbach said he works hard for his constituents. I've always felt that when I'm in Des Moines, it is like them being there themselves. Taking a look over now at sports, we have from Kickoff 2020, the Western Dubuque Bobcats. Bobcats back at work. 2 years ago, Western Dubuque snuck up on teams in the postseason. Last year, nobody was sleeping on the Bobcats, but they still couldn't be stopped. This year? Well, that's a question after the Bobcats graduated an overwhelming number of starters and key contributors. But it isn't really a question in Epworth. Last year, we had a great run. We know that happened, but we're just focusing on this year, said returning offensive lineman Owen Hatcher. We don't want to ride that into week one. We know this is a new team, and we have to work hard to try to do it again. Western Dubuque goes from hunter to hunted after winning last year's Iowa Class 3A state title, the second in program history, and making its second consecutive appearance in the state title game. But most of the players who keyed that run, and there are far too many to list them all, have moved on to the next stage, leaving a new crop of players to step up and try to establish Iowa's next high school football dynasty. There's no hiding that we lost a lot of good seniors and a lot of good players, obviously, said linebacker Sawyer Nauman. I think we're in a better scenario if they say that we won't be as good this year. They'll kind of be overlooking us. We still have a lot of talent on our team. Perhaps the biggest hole to fill will be one left at quarterback. After the graduation of two-time Telegraph Herald Player of the Year, Calvin Harris, who set virtually every passing record over his two-year career and accounted for 41 touchdowns last year, 29 passing, 12 rushing. Garrett Baumhauer, a senior, is a projected starter. As far as returning skill position players, there aren't too many that touched the ball last season. Tommy DeSoler caught 19 passes for 287 yards and 4 touchdowns last year. Tight end Logan Brocious had 12 receptions for 133 yards and a score. And Nauman had 1 reception for 8 yards. Nauman is the top returning tackler after making 40 stops with a sack, 4.5 tackles for loss, and 2 fumble recoveries. Penner and his staff are eager to see who will be the players to step up and lead this team. You just do it your best to put the best 11 guys you can on the field. Coach those guys up and just take a look and see how good you can get, he said. If your goal every year is to win the big one, that's understandable. But if you come up short, is your season a disappointment? I don't think that outcome-based approach is going to make you happy. It's not going to make you enjoy it. We've always been pretty process-based and passionate about the process and enjoying it as we go. When I reflect on last year, that was the part I really enjoyed, And I guess I don't want to get worried about an outcome right now, especially since we don't know what COVID-19 has in store for us. We might as well just enjoy it as it lasts. Western Dubuque hasn't yet seen the boost in participation numbers at the varsity level one would expect after a two-year run that resulted in 23 wins in 26 games. In fact, after having almost 50 players on the 2018 state runner-up team and nearly the same on last year's undefeated championship team, Penner said he has fewer than 36 players on the varsity roster this fall. A vast majority of the number ones on the Bobcats depth chart will be new varsity starters. This year, more than any other year, that depth is really going to play a role in things, Penner said. We can certainly have some guys who we think can step in and evolve. And we like to think that some of the guys that came before, they weren't there yet either at the beginning of the year. He will continue recruiting the Western Dubuque hallways for new prospects, noting that this year's team includes just 13 juniors. There's some good athletes that are walking the halls that I just haven't sold on football, and I'll use the word yet strongly after that and say I haven't sold them on football yet, Penner said. But one area in which Western Dubuque has seen a boost in numbers is at the lower levels. Penner said the freshman and sophomore teams have more than 80 kids out for the sport this fall. It may be hard to judge this year, considering the nation is in the midst of a coronavirus pandemic, but last year's youth flag and tackle football league saw a 20% growth in participation as well, Penner said. That was significant, he said. Little kids go and see success on Friday night under the lights, and they want to be a part of that. So hopefully those numbers will pay off in time. How starving public health fueled a COVID fire in Florida. On a sweltering July morning, Rose Wilson struggled to breathe as she sat in her bed, the light from her computer illuminating her face and the oxygen tubes in her nose. Wilson, a retiree who worked as a public health department nurse supervisor in Duval County for 35 years, had just been diagnosed with COVID-19-induced pneumonia. Staring back from her screen was Dr. Rogers Kane, who runs a tidy little family medical clinic in North Jacksonville, a predominantly black area where the coronavirus is running roughshod. Wilson, age 81, was having a telemedicine appointment, one of 8 COVID patients he saw in just the hours before noon. Kane and Wilson are nervous. For years, both watched as the county health department was gutted of money and people, hampering Duval's ability to respond to outbreaks. And now they face the menace of COVID-19 in one of the leading states in the latest U.S. surge. Florida is both a microcosm and a cautionary tale for America. As the nation starved its public health system, staffing and funding fell faster and further in the Sunshine State, leaving it especially unprepared for the worst healthcare crisis in a century. Although Florida's population grew by 2.4 million since 2010, a joint investigation by KHN and the Associated Press has found the state slashed its local health department staffing from 12,422 full-time equivalent workers to 9,125 in 2019, the latest data available. The state-run local health departments spent 41% less per resident in 2019 than 2010, according to an analysis of state data, dropping from $57 to $34 after accounting for inflation. Departments nationwide have also cut spending, but by less than half as much, according to the data from the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Even before the pandemic hit, that meant fewer disease investigators to track, trace, and contain disease such as hepatitis. When the wave of COVID-19 inundated Florida, its main lines of defense had been eviscerated. Now, confirmed cases have soared past 588,000 and deaths surpassed 10,000. Concerns over the virus prompted Republicans to cancel plans for this week's in-person national convention in Jacksonville. Health experts blame the funding cuts on the Great Recession and choices by a series of governors who wanted to move publicly funded state services to for-profit companies. And when the pandemic took hold, they say, residents got mixed messages about prevention strategies like wearing masks from Republican Governor Ron DeSantis and other public leaders. Voices within the health department were muzzled. The reality, unfortunately, is people are going to die because of the irresponsibility of the decisions being made by the people crafting the budgets, said Ron Bialik, president of the Public Health Foundation, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., that offers tools and training to improve public health. State officials neither answered specific, repeated questions from the Associated Press and KHN about the changes in public health funding, nor made staffers available for deeper explanations. Dr. Leslie Beisch, a former deputy secretary of Florida's State Health Department, said failing to prepare for a foreseeable disaster is governmental malpractice. The nation's pandemic response is only as good as the weakest link, he said. Since the virus respects no borders, other states feel ripples of Florida's failings. Records show businesses held sway over state reopening plans. As South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster prepared to announce the end of a coronavirus stay-at-home order, his top staff received an email from the state health department. The message, highlighted in bold, was clear. Wait longer before allowing customers back inside restaurants, hair salons, and other businesses where people will be in close contact. Instead, McMaster pressed ahead with a plan written by the State Restaurant Association to resume inside dining on May 11th. The guidelines made masks optional for employees and allowed more customers inside than the health agency had advised. A few days later, the Republican governor opened the doors to salons, fitness centers, and swimming pools. He did not wait to gauge the effect of the restaurant reopening on the virus, as public health officials had advised. Like many states, South Carolina later experienced a surge in infections that forced McMaster to dial back his reopening plan. He was hardly alone. Thousands of pages of emails provided to the Associated Press under open records laws show that governors across the U.S. were inundated with reopening advice from a wide range of industries, from campgrounds in New Hampshire to car washes in Washington. Some governors put economic interests ahead of public health guidance, and certain businesses were allowed to write the rules that would govern their own operations. As job losses accelerated, the pressure to reopen intensified. Attraction folks are on me like white on rice, McMaster's tourism director wrote to the head of the governor's reopening task force, describing lobbying from amusement parks, bingo halls, and other entertainment venues. Though governors often work with business leaders to craft policy, the emails offer a new window into their decisions during a critical early juncture in the nation's battle against the pandemic. Many governors chose to reopen before their states met all the nationally recommended health guidelines, which include a sustained downward rate of infection and robust testing and contact tracing. The interest in trying to reopen and restart economic activity had a much greater pull at the time than did public health concerns or question marks about how it would go, said Anita Cicero, deputy director of the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Many states were forced to halt or roll back their reopening plans as COVID-19 cases spiked across the country this summer, and the number of infections and deaths in the U.S. far outpaced those of any other country. In early August, McMaster transformed his restaurant guidelines into requirements, including a mandate that all diners and employees wear masks. The governor's spokesman, Brian Sims, said some restaurants weren't doing what they needed to do. Sims also defended the spring reopening, saying the governor has a wider scope of responsibility and focus than our public health officials. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, August 24th, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Iris Irish Iris. Short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers. From Dubuque. Don Dweebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers, he told me. I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library. While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers' strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checkers' strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Duber, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training. Don said he unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. It's like the Mona Lisa, Mr. Checker said, of his museum. You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dweebar. If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.